National Gallery Podcast.
This is the National Gallery Podcast, and I'm Miranda Hinckley. We begin with some female prophets from antiquity who aren't all they seem, the Sibyls. The National Gallery recently acquired a magnificent depiction of the Samian Sibyl by the great 17th century painter Guercino to add to the master's equally imposing Cumaean Sibyl already in the collection. Who were these oracles? They feature in many ancient texts, including Virgil's Aeneid. Were they anything like the bookish beauties Guercino imagines them to be? To provide some answers, the classicist, writer, broadcaster, and one-time stand-up comedian Natalie Haynes came into the gallery.
Now, first and foremost, who were the Sibyls and what did they get up to?
Women who are, in theory, divinely inspired by the gods to offer predictions of the future. But like all predictions of the future in the ancient world, they are tricksy. It's very important that you remember this because they can't be trusted. So there's quite a famous story of a king sending messengers out to all the oracles that are available in the ancient world. And he tells them all to ask the oracle what he's doing at this exact moment. And only one of them, I think Delphi, gives the right answer, which is that he is boiling a tortoise. I'm, of course, not joking. And so at that point, he goes, well, this oracle is the right one. And so he then gets them to ask the question, if he invades, will he win, basically? And the oracle replies, a great empire will be destroyed. And he goes, quid's in, let me go for it. And of course, it is his empire, which is destroyed. The oracle takes you down again.
Now this, as you say, this is Guercino's version of the Cumaean Sibyl, and she's looking very neat and tidy. She's got these beautiful robes on, she's got a turban over her rather lovely hair. She looks quite a nice character. Does that fit with the ancient version of what Sibyls were about?
She is quite wholesome, isn't she? Although the pages of her book are a little bit... Maybe she's been reading them in the bath, do you know what I mean? They've gone a little bit curly around the edges. So perhaps she's a bathing Sibyl. But yeah, no, she does look very respectable compared with... In Aeneid 6, when we find the Sibyl there, one, she lives in a cave. This is crucial. Two, the cave has, I think, 100 entrances. So 100 voices of the Sibyl, responses of the Sibyl can bounce back out at you. And when she's sort of inspired by the voice of God, then her colour changes and her face changes, her hair becomes dishevelled and she becomes taller, and she obviously operates in some sort of, at this inspired moment, in a kind of place between God and man. She is a sort of acting as a bridge at that moment. So she takes on a sort of physical guise, which is not wholly human at that point. And this Sibyl looks extremely human. She looks very respectable. The fabric that she's wearing looks like silk, doesn't it? It looks really sheeny and expensive and nice. So this is not a woman who lives in a cave, I'm going to say. And plus, I don't know how you'd get those earrings in if you didn't have a mirror.
And for women in the ancient world, was being a Sibyl a good career option, do you think?
No, I think it might not have been too bad, actually. I think, basically, you live in a cave, so it depends how sort of camping-ish you are, and then you chew some leaves and, you know, purport to be inspired by the god, say a few quite random things, occasionally write down a sort of gnomic utterance here and there in your Sibylline oracles, which are considered incredibly valuable by the people around you. And then I think you can probably do pretty much what you like. Certainly for the Greeks, women often have these very secluded existences. You know, they're kept in the women's... If you're an Athenian wife, you would be in the 5th century. You'd be kept in the women's quarters of your home. You would never go out other than with servants and your husband. So you'd have a very isolated existence, really. So I'm not sure it would be too bad being a Sibyl. As long as you didn't mind the, you know, cave dwelling, I think it'd be okay.
Natalie Haynes talking about Guercino's Cumaean Sibyl with a puto, which hangs alongside his Samian Sibyl with a puto in room 32. If you arrive via the main entrance in Trafalgar Square, the first room you're likely to come across is Central Hall, a gallery devoted to 16th century portraits from northern Italy. Italian artists of that period worked hard to evoke their sitters' presence as vividly as possible, which makes experiencing their intensely alive paintings en masse a little like walking into a historic costume party in full swing. The handsome subject of Moretto da Brescia's portrait of a young man seems particularly keen to catch our eye. He leans his chin on his left hand, staring out at us disconsolately. Jonathan Jones, author of The Loves of the Artists, Art and Passion in the Renaissance, finds this rather mopey wannabe Romeo fascinating. He told Cathy Fitzgerald why.
Moretto da Brescia's portrait of a young man always calls me up as one of the most lovable paintings in the National Gallery. He's wearing incredibly ornate garments, kind of green silk. The colours are lovely. We don't always think of portraits as great colour paintings, but this one has this beautiful dark green in which he's clad, sort of silken, green silk satin. And then there's white fur in which the texture is wonderfully captured. So he's clearly a wealthy youth who is very aware that he's posing for his portrait, let's say. It's a slightly theatrical portrait. Basically, it's almost a humour to it that's just kind of really likeable.
And so in your book, The Loves of the Artists, you talk about this painting as sort of encapsulating a cultural shift that happens around the 16th century in terms of the idea of love.
Basically, in the Renaissance, you have an intense culture of love. Love is a kind of secular religion. You know, it's lust, it's longing, it's very much of this world. But it's also about looking inward, about the experience of love as a tenderness, a longing, a suffering. And, of course, it's about the self.
So it becomes a very introspective emotion.
Like this young man. I mean, the young man in Moretto de Brescia's painting. On his cap badge, there's a motto, you know, "Alas, I desire too much," which does seem to me to suggest kind of love again, and that he's longing for what he can't quite have. Mm. You know, it's this love as something which is frustrating, and a passion for life, really, which is just, you know, cannot be fulfilled because it's so vast. You know, so the paradox is, and this is again the paradox of love itself, perhaps, is that, you know, it's an idea. Love's an idea, and in the Renaissance, it very much is, you know, a convention. But then it becomes a reality as well. And so, while in some ways the painting seems quite funny, his pose seems quite contrived, what he's saying through his cap badge, through his motto, "Alas, I desire too much," is actually a universal statement about the human condition, which is deeply moving. It sums up what I love about the Renaissance, actually, which is that they recognise the human condition not in a kind of dry philosophical way. You know, other great kind of cultural moments often tend to produce these kind of cogent philosophies, whether it's Plato in ancient Greece or Karl Marx in the 19th century or whatever, these people with answers. What's great about the Renaissance, they didn't actually have any fixed answers. They were just interested and fascinated and curious. And I think this young man's on a voyage of discovery, and that's the point. It's a voyage of discovery, discovery of the world and of the human.
Thanks to Jonathan Jones. You can find Moretto's Portrait of a Young Man on display in the gallery's central hall, and Jonathan Jones will be talking about his love of the Renaissance at a special event at the National Gallery on the 20th of September. Details at www.nationalgallery.org.uk. It's said that travel expands the mind, but as a wonderful portrait of a globe-trotting earl by Anthony van Dyck shows, it can also influence your choice of clothes. Leah Caribbean met award-winning costume designer and director of the School of Historical Dress, Jenny Tiramani, to find out more.
Jenny, this is a big, nearly 3-metre-high portrait, and it shows William Fielding, 1st Earl of Denbigh, as a vigorous, if rather portly man in his 50s, looking up at a parrot in a palm tree that's just been pointed out by a turbaned serving boy below. But that's all really rather incidental, because it's Fielding's wonderful red outfit that really catches our attention. And we know that Fielding had been in both India and Persia a couple of years before this picture was painted in 1633-4. And I was wondering, is this an Oriental outfit that he's wearing?
I'd say it's a sort of fusion outfit, actually. It's a mixture between Asian garments and Western garments. He's wearing a shirt which really looks like a Western white linen shirt to me, with a very elaborately, possibly embroidered collar, comes over the top of what I would call, similar to a European man's night jacket at this period, and the trouser is much more Asian, but the upper body garment is more of a Western garment to me. It's got buttons and buttonholes are pretty Western.
Are they?
At this period, I think yes. It would be more common if this was a truly Asian garment for it to have buttons and loops, if that was the fastening, or to have ties.
So the buttonholes are very Western, the shirt is very Western. He's got these Indian pyjama trousers, but he's wearing what looks to me, I have to say, Jenny, like the ultimate fashion no-no of socks and sandals. Is that what he's wearing on his feet?
No, he's not. He's wearing a really normal pair of men's European shoes with a heel and tied at the front. The latchets or straps come from the heel and tie at the front of the vamp. It's perfectly normal, and I think he's wearing a pair of silk stockings matching the colour of the silk outfit, this lovely carnation pink. But I think it's the combination of the two that's so incongruous and makes him look slightly peculiar. I think he would cause some interest, and he would look very different if he was in Western society walking around wearing this. But he is in an Eastern landscape, so presumably he's trying to depict himself as a memory of you know, where he was on his travels. But he would have looked very odd to an Eastern eye, I think, as well.
So he's a bit odd and eccentric all round.
Yes, but, you know, he seems very comfortable with himself, doesn't he? And in the sense, you know, he doesn't look like he cares, really.
I think that's the best way to be, isn't it, about one's fashion?
Yes, indeed. Confident.
Jenny Tiramani talking about Van Dyck's portrait of William Fielding, on display in Room 31. That's it for this episode. If you're visiting this month, don't forget we're open 10 till 6 daily and till 9 on Fridays. Or you can get a closer look at all the paintings online at www.nationalgallery.org.uk. Until next month, goodbye.